From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Noe Valley, San Francisco.
DuBose Triangle, Lower Haven.
Visitation Valley.
Downtown San Francisco.
Oh, Ingleside, SF.
Coming up, we hear the story of a local transgender immigrant waiting to be deported who says she'd rather kill herself than be returned to her home country.
Me having breasts and other things. I knew as soon as I got back to Liberia, they were going to take me into custody. So why not end it?
We'll hear how she fought for asylum to stay in the U.S., but also how she was kept in solitary confinement while in detention. Then we visit a music festival powered only by bikes.
Kind of harvesting from the human garden of sweat.
Don't stop pedaling. That and more today on Cross Currents. Stay tuned. Recently, most discussions about the prison system have centered either on the quantity of prisons and overloading the system, or the overwhelming numbers of minorities in prisons, health care in prisons, and in the case of California, what to do with thousands of prisoners when they're released. One issue that may not be on the radar is prison rape. The government decided to start gathering data on the issue with the passage of the Prison Rape Elimination Act in 2003. This year, it was updated to include specific protections for transgender, lesbian, and gay inmates. Studies show that transgender inmates are especially vulnerable to physical and sexual abuse. They're up to 13 times more likely to be sexually assaulted, according to reports by transgender rights advocates. Often, transgender inmates are placed in protective custody, also known as solitary confinement, to protect them from abuse. The act now limits the use of solitary confinement for transgender inmates in response to advocates saying it was inhumane. But these protections don't extend to immigrants held in detention centers or county jails. People like Grace Lawrence, a transgender woman from Liberia who was in custody for nearly 3 years. For all but 6 months, she was kept in solitary confinement for 23 hours a day.
So it was so hard. But that's just me. But the same thing was happening to other transgender that was around me.
Lawyers and advocates argue that continuing to keep immigrant transgender detainees in solitary confinement creates barriers for them, including limiting their access to legal help. Reporter Nancy Lopez tells us Lawrence's story.
Grace Lawrence was born Wellington Felix Lawrence in Monrovia, Liberia.
I'm the oldest of 7 children, and I had to live a double life, and I couldn't speak about me being a trans woman, not even to my mother or my best friend, because I knew the penalty would be death.
That was Lawrence's fear. In Liberia, homosexuality isn't actually punishable by death, but sodomy is considered a first-degree misdemeanor and carries a year-long prison sentence. The predominantly Christian population is pushing for even more criminalizing of being gay or transgender.
This is leading our country to extinction.
We will not condone such a practice. Such a demonic thing should not go in our society.
And we'll fight against
Amen.
It.
Amen.
Amen. Amen. Amen.
Growing up, Lawrence kept quiet and played the role of the oldest son. In her teens, her family moved to Minnesota. Eventually, she got married to a woman and had 2 children. But by her 30s, she realized she couldn't continue living as a man.
I told my mom that I wasn't only gay, but I think that I was a woman. And they said that I was crazy and they didn't want to have nothing to do with me. So I was kicked out of the family. So I came to San Francisco and tried to find my life and find myself.
Lawrence is built like a football player. Over 6 feet tall and muscular. But she has breasts, loves to wear neon green, and has her nails done. When she got here, she was 37 years old, and that's when she began her transition from male to female. As an undocumented immigrant, Lawrence felt she had few options for making a living, especially considering the high cost of transitioning. So she quickly got caught up in drug dealing and using. Lawrence also depended on prostitution to get by, but she still could only afford to live in a hotel room.
Then you got to remember, oh, I got to go hustle for rent today. You know what I'm saying? And if you don't have rent by 6 in the evening, the hotel manager will double lock the doors.
In late 2006, police arrested Lawrence for possession of crack cocaine. Drug possession and prostitution are deportable crimes for immigrants like Lawrence. So after she served her two-month sentence, she was turned over to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. While awaiting deportation in Santa Clara County Jail, Lawrence was immediately placed in solitary confinement for her protection. That is a general policy for trans detainees, because they are more likely to be assaulted. She was let out for 1 hour each day, and she says that hour went by fast.
There are certain times the child molester people come out, you know, and then there are certain times the transgender people come out, and then there are certain times the gangster, you have some, you know, people who drop out of gangs and stuff like that, they come out because we all are in under the isolation or protected custody. And so when you come out, first you got to take your shower, then you got to get on the phone, and you got like 15 minutes to talk to your other friends, you know, because they would let the transgenders out together, you know, would talk, and some people would show pictures, and some of the girls would just be crying, and you just there. I mean, you just in your head, and you're like, oh my God, when would this go away?
Lauren says if she was lucky, she'd be let out before 5 p.m. so she could contact her lawyer. But more often than not, she says she was let out at night, after business hours. So Lauren says when she got back to her cell, she'd spend her time writing letters, frantically, asking for help.
You know, I would write letters to my friends, to my lawyer. I would even write letters to the judge, explaining, you know, please don't deport me. This is what will happen. You know what I'm saying? Anybody who I could write, I would write. So I'd rather die than going over to Liberia, having kerosene or gasoline wasted on me and being burned alive, you know, and stuff that they do those things. I've seen it happen to gay people.
We couldn't find reports corroborating Lawrence's claims, but Liberia's current president, Nobel Peace Prize winner Alan Johnson Sirleaf, recently defended the country's current policies.
But at the moment, I mean, voluntary sodomy is illegal at the moment. So in essence, homosexuality for two gay men under the books is illegal in Liberia.
We've got certain traditional values in our society that we'd like to preserve.
This is why Grace Lawrence says she was so afraid of returning to Liberia. So she asked her lawyer to help her seek asylum here in the U.S. But it was still difficult to even communicate.
It's harder to prepare a case for someone who is spending 23 hours a day in administrative segregation. It's harder for them to get out and call me. It's harder for them to get out and call whatever legal advocate might be helping them.
Kara Jobson is a lawyer in San Francisco who's handled hundreds of cases involving immigrant LGBT detainees. She says cases like Lawrence's drag on longer because of their limited access. And Jobson says many of her transgender clients end up agreeing to leave the country voluntarily.
Which they accepted without fighting because the conditions were so bad in jail and because they had no access to information about asylum. And we see a lot of times people don't get their hormones. It's very depressing. It's very physically traumatic for them. It's emotionally traumatic. There's things that go on in the jails, you know, harassment.
So we were called names, you know, faggot, you know, sissy, you know, different names. When we was taking showers, for those of us who had breasts, you know, they would look at us and comment about it and stuff like that.
The Department of Homeland Security declined to be interviewed for this story, stating that the agency does not offer comments on specific allegations. But DHS did provide this statement, saying, quote, ICE has a strict zero-tolerance policy for any kind of abusive or inappropriate behavior in its facilities and takes any allegations of such mistreatment very seriously, end quote. After 3 years in detention, Lawrence suffered a mental breakdown. The first time an immigration judge ordered her to be deported, she attempted suicide.
because I know there was no life for me in Liberia if I was deported. I said goodbye to my two children, you know, in my heart. I was mad at my family. I was mad at the world. I felt useless, worthless, unwanted. I had nothing left. I have no family member here in California. And so it was the end. It was the end for Gracie Lawrence. So I took my sheets, the bed sheets, and ripped it and made a rope high enough. And
a guard arrived just in time to stop her. Lawrence spent the next 6 months in the psychiatric ward of an immigration hospital in San Diego. She was prescribed medication, but would attempt suicide again when faced with another possibility of deportation a year or so later. It seems like just when Lawrence had lost all hope, she got some good news. It was late 2009 when she was called to appear in court, and she remembers the judge's exact words.
This case is dismissed. I wish you luck, Miss Lawrence. And that's what the judge said. When I went back in the holding cell and then I was on my way back to Santa Clara, shackles as usual, but this time I was so happy. I was so happy because I knew that when the paperwork go through, I would be coming downtown to San Francisco and they would release me.
Lawrence's lawyer, Kara Jobson, had proven that if Lawrence were deported to Liberia, she would be tortured and killed for being transgender. So she was granted asylum under the United States Convention Against Torture. This is one of the more difficult types of asylum cases to win.
Most people who live it and go through it, majority of them are deported and never make it back, like me, to be able to tell the stories of what go on in there.
Lawrence now has a driver's license and a work permit. She volunteers with the TGI Justice Project in San Francisco, where she provides guidance to other transgender immigrant women. And there may be hope for those who are still in detention. President Obama has directed the Department of Homeland Security to draft its own standards for protecting LGBT immigrant detainees from physical and sexual abuse. This would include alternatives to the use of solitary confinement. DHS has until mid-September to comply. In San Francisco, I'm Nancy Lopez for Cross Currents.
Tomorrow, there's an event that's meant to empower the transgendered community in where else but San Francisco. The San Francisco Trans March promises to be a sober, family-friendly event, too. More information is at kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. San Francisco is known for a couple of things. Being LGBT conscious is one. Another is that it's a notoriously bike-friendly town. The famous Critical Mass ride began right here in 1992. Now, on any given day or night, pretty much, you can find biking events with a collective spirit. The SF Bike Party, the casual Wednesday evening butterlap ride, group tours led by the San Francisco Bicycle Coalition. So it makes perfect sense that the city by the bay would be home to the first all-pedal-powered outdoor music festival. It took place on June 18th last year and is coming up this Saturday again. KALW's Ali Budner brings us this postcard from last year's party from our archives.
It's a sunny morning at Stowe Lake Meadow in Golden Gate Park, and the grass is already strewn with bikes. Amid the tinkering and worrying sounds of pedals and wheels, there's an excited chatter of voices. The fifth annual Bicycle Music Festival is getting into gear. And for this festival, musicians aren't the only ones warming up.
My name is Baron Hirschberger, and I think I'm generating power for some sound checks and testing.
Hirschberger is just one of scores of volunteers who will power the stage with their own legs.
And really, I'm just trying to make these lights in front of me turn blue, which are flashing red right now.
Is it hard?
Well, it's I wouldn't say it's hard, but it's definitely demanding, as you can hear by my breathing. But it's fun. It's fun to see how much power it takes.
Kind of harvesting from the Human Garden of Sweat.
Gabe Dominguez co-founded this festival with Paul Friedman of Rock the Bike, a Berkeley-based business that provides pedal-powered stages for various events. Dominguez breaks down how it works.
So Lance Armstrong can put out 500 watts when he's bicycling down the street.
Lance Armstrong needs that power to keep moving.
But if you elevated Lance Armstrong's rear wheel and he was pedaling in place, if you hooked it up to a generator, instead of using electricity, you'd be producing electricity. And so if you hook that motor up to Lance Armstrong's wheel, you'd get 500 watts of power that you can use to run anything you want.
Like a concert. Generating power with bicycles isn't a new idea. Even powering a stage with bikes has been done before.
In the 80s, up in Humboldt, this guy named Bart Orlando was doing pedal-powered concerts. And he had a giant pedal-powered sound system that he would bring in on a truck bed, and it would be hauled in but with fossil fuels.
But for this event, everything needed is packed in and packed out on the backs of bicycles.
Hauling, like, giant speakers and just huge bags of audio equipment and bicycle-powered ice cream makers and just so much stuff.
The festival needs between 2 and 5 kilowatt hours of power to run the mics, lights, amps, and speakers for the 14 bands performing throughout the day. The power comes from volunteers in the audience who take turns pedaling. And you can actually see when the bikers get tired because the sound will literally falter or the lights will flicker. This can also happen if the bikers get too excited and overburden the system. Many of the people who attend the Bicycle Music Festival are already steeped in bike culture, like Jonathan Ute.
Last year we brought our bicycle puppet show and promoting bike advocacy to younger generations. So stop every time at the edge of the street. Use your head before your feet. Make sure you hear every sound. Look left, right, left, and all around. You know, that's the stop signs rhyme.
But you don't have to be a bike buff to show up and have a good time.
My name's Mara.
I'm Jesse. And we're just...
I actually get the Twitter feed 494121, which is our zip code, and this was listed on it, so that's how we learned about it.
And the music here is as varied as the audience.
Thanks for coming out this morning. I would like to introduce, without much further ado, the kickoff band for our festival. Please give it up for Stitchcraft.
We hold this day close to our hearts.
We have bands performing through the day, ranging from opera to bhangra to rock and roll to bluegrass. We had a barn dance this year, a big square dance with a dance caller.
Dominguez's personal favorite moment of the day happened during the Live on Bike procession. See, the Bicycle Music Festival wouldn't be quite complete without an actual bike ride, so...
Halfway through the day, after we've had a great time at Golden Gate Park, we pack up the entire festival again onto our bikes and our bike trailers. And that's the bands, the audience, the volunteers, everybody's on bicycles. We don't use any cars. And we have a mobile stage that we built this year that's as wide as a semi-truck. And so it takes up an entire lane of traffic. Two opera singers from San Francisco Conservatory jumped up on there and were singing Puccini in the streets of San Francisco while people are running to the windows of their apartments and looking down, and people are coming out of the stores with half-eaten burritos and just cheering, and traffic is pulling over and people are rolling down their windows because they want to hear this opera, this baritone and the soprano just singing.
After a glorious operatic serenade through the streets, the whole bike parade ends up at the bottom of Potrero Hill in Showplace Triangle for Act 2 of the festival.
We set up all the bikes, we set up all the stage, microphones, info station, bike blended, smoothie station, everything. And then 5 more bands perform into the night.
It's a party atmosphere, yeah. But for Dominguez, for the volunteers, and for many festival goers, this event has a deeper significance.
It's a life-changing moment when they see what we're capable of. not only in terms of creating electricity or something like that, what we can do in terms of our ingenuity and just creativity and wacky inventiveness, but also in terms of what human beings are capable of in terms of grassroots organizing for the sake of fun and art and reshaping our city.
And other cities are catching on, from San Francisco to Chico, Seattle, Vancouver, and as far away as Vienna, London, Australia.
This guy wrote us from Taiwan. There's just people all the time, a guy in Amazonia, Brazil, people letting us know that they're starting their own.
But it all started right here in San Francisco. I'm Allie Budner for Cross Currents.
This year's Bicycle Music Festival is this Saturday. We've got all the information for you at kalw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Some people bike for fun or for the environment. For others, it's a money-saving, fitness-improving way of getting to work. However you get to work and however you feel about work, we want to know about it. Here at KALW, we have a team of producers who've been asking people in San Francisco and Oakland for their personal stories about getting jobs, being on the job, and leaving jobs. It's part of a new community storytelling project from KALW.
Here.
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 Okay, together. Okay.
Here, here.
A pop-up radio project.
Our Hear Hear producers recently met a young man in the Mission Bay district of San Francisco. He asked that his last name not be used, and this is his story.
And any discrepancies that the apartment complex has, we can also log those.
My name is Josh, and I live in San Francisco, California.
Help him out. That's pretty much all we do, actually. And then we check keys out.
Right now, we're at UCSF Mission Bay Housing in the mailroom of the housing office, which is located in the Mission Bay District, in between the ballpark and the dog patch district of San Francisco. My title here is tenant assistant. I let people into their apartment that have either lost their keys or have been locked out for some reason. This is by far the easiest job I've ever had in my life. If you can read or write or move a package, you've got this job down pat. Well, my resume right now would probably look like 4 years surveillance in the military, 4 years special operations forces, military, multiple combat deployments in two wars, and a surveillance mission down in South America, and Denny's. I have a scar on my bicep, on my right bicep up top, actually two, there's the small one. Special operations, it's very, very not like Mission Impossible. A lot of these missions that they do in Hollywood are, they're ridiculous is what they are. They're not good at Kung Fu. They can fight, but they're not good at Kung Fu. They're really good at killing, but not in the killing sense that you would think, special forces guys can kill you with their pinky. It's not true. Basically, training for a triathlon is how I was told to train for this. They're looking for people that won't quit when it's really, really hard. They're looking for people that probably won't quit until they die. The first firefight I'd ever been in, I remember feeling rounds coming in, bullets coming in, that just was this dull, almost push feeling, but it was all bad. But when you come back from that and then you go to this unlocking doors, some upset tenant that they have to pay a $25 fee because you're unlocking their door because they forgot their keys in it. It's a huge transition. there's a term that we use a lot. A lot of guys on team or operators, the term salty. Some people call it PTSD. Just realized that I was pretty salty about it. It's really, really hard. A lot of people have a huge problem dealing with it, so much to the point where they end up leaving that life that they wanted and going back into it, going back into the military. So I'd say at first it was a hard transition, but it slowly gets better. And you become like the people that you used to complain about, which is kind of ironic. Yeah.
To share your story with Hear Here, a pop-up radio project, go online to hearhere.kalw.org. That's H-E-A-R-H-E-R-E at kalw.org and click on Participate. That's also where you can find out where our Hear Here producers will be popping up next. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Julie Kane, Audrey Dilling, Fatima Duran, Brian Flagg, Emily Gaddick, Nina Gensler-Debs, Jordan Katz, RTM's Konohovs, Taja Lanier, Eric Amu, Seth Samuel, Stephen Short, Isaac Silk, and Mario Wallof. Today's show is engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Martina Castro is our managing editor. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thank you. We are listener-supported radio. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.